hope you're doing well. My name is Anahita Sen, and I'm a co-facilitator of the M&A Stories YouTube podcast, which is brought to you by Fifth Chrome Business Insights. Welcome to Season 3. The theme of this season is culture and its impact on M&A integration. Culture is one of the biggest challenges that face an M&A integration. And this challenge couldn't get any bigger, as more companies are pursuing M&A based on people and culture. That is why it is important to understand, internalize, respect, and develop a clear plan of action on how to handle culture in M&A. In this season, we will be interviewing industry leaders from across the globe to hear their stories on how they address culture in an M&A integration. So here we go with today's episode.
Hi there. Welcome to another episode of M&A Stories. Today, we have our guest who is joining us all the way from Australia, Robert Heaton, originally from the UK. He's spent more than a couple of decades in this space. He's worked both in a corporate life as well as in the independent consulting world. And he's worked across different cultures around the globe. So who better to have on our episode as our guest than Robert Heaton? Ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome Robert Heaton.
Thank you, Anavan. It's a great introduction and a pleasure to be on your podcast.
Brilliant. You and I, we've done a couple of podcasts already together. So this is going to be more like sharing a coffee or maybe a beer with a friend, a kind of a discussion.
I would agree. We're fellow professionals in that sense. So we're both deeply skilled in the topic that we love as a day-to-day activity. You and I can talk naturally on this sort of topic.
Brilliant. Why don't we start with a brief introduction? What makes you Robert Heaton?
I'll try and give a very high level background. I started my career in manufacturing industry. I won't go into the detail, but it led into consulting. I was assigned to the chairman's office of the manufacturing company for a while. And that led into management consulting. In the typical way we understand management consulting, I was helping companies around Europe with advanced technologies at the time, early robotics, automated manufacturing systems, and so on. And then there was a progression from there into the technology industry, and I spent more than 20-odd years globally in the technology industry. And for anybody that's been in that tech industry, you get moved around a lot. So for me, I was originally brought into the tech industry in the UK. I then got moved to Australia. I got moved from Australia to Germany. I got moved from Germany to the United States twice, and now back to Australia. All of that time, or the majority of that time, in senior management and leadership positions in the industry. And I always say that I was always in the wrong place at the right time, because when that industry made acquisitions, which is a standard for that industry, it was always a question of, hey, Rob, could you go and do this? Rob, could you go and have a look at that? Rob, we've just made an acquisition in, and so that was my birth, if you like, into mergers and acquisitions on a regular basis. It was multiple roles. Sometimes it was pre-deal due diligence, sometimes it was post-deal integration, sometimes it was acting as the interim CEO for a while. And that's where I cut my teeth in terms of M&A. And about 2015, I was a senior position for Cisco, and I just got to that point where I'd had an absolute belly full of the tech industry. Right? The same Monday morning management meetings, the same commit calls, I'd had enough. And that brought me into M&A as an individual. So I'm now the managing partner for a company called Global PMI Partners. And I'm the managing partner for Australia and New Zealand. And that brings us up to today.
Brilliant. And given your background, you definitely have had exposure to different kinds of cultures, you know, not just the regional cultures, you know, culture that differs from country to country, but you've also been exposed to organizational culture, which is culture of, let's say, company Cisco, culture of SAP. What is culture and why is it important in M&A?
Well, culture for me is a whole set of behaviors that combine to exhibit themselves as the way that an organization behaves, both internally and also externally towards its clients and its stakeholders and its partners and so on and so forth. And it could be driven by multiple factors, which I'm sure we'll come on to later today. There's no one topic that you can say that's culture. It's generally, in most cases, hopefully, it is driven by from the top, from the senior leadership team and the way they want to run the business. It's also strengthened by the way that that is then absorbed by lower levels of the organization and the way they act and behave. And at a high level, it's often why we sometimes say a company is development-led, finance-driven, you know, customer-centric. Those are sort of words that we use sometimes to sort of put a broad heading on the culture of a business. So I hope that sort of gives a quick feel for what I think culture is.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this is something that you and I, we have spoken on it a couple of times in the past. Trying to define organization culture in a structured sentence often becomes difficult. And that's what people say. It's the way we behave, or it's the way we do things here in a company. And what I've also seen, I'm sure you would have seen the same, which is large companies have a more definitive culture compared to smaller companies or mid-sized companies. I mean, let's say when you work with SAP, you would probably have a much more defined culture. You know, I had the same when I joined GE, Jack Welch was still around. It had a very Jack Welch stamped culture, you know, and we're going to sort of unpack that as we go along. What makes up culture? Because culture is not, it's not something that gets created by itself. You know, things, factors make culture. What makes culture?
Well, you've said it in the sentence. There are multiple building blocks to what we eventually call culture of a business. And it's a set of behavior styles and principles. Let me try and just put a few examples in place. If you happen to work in the pharmaceutical industry, you are automatically exposed to the fact that you've got things like FDA approvals. It's a heavily regulated industry. Quality assurance is of the highest possible standard. There's all sorts of ethics involved in the business. And so those factors alone actually start to impact on the way the business works, the way that decisions are made. Because if we compare that to, let's say, a heavy engineering business, right, where safety is a very strong culture in the business, right? But I don't want to do the engineering industry a disservice, but things like, you know, strong governance, ethics, regulatory controls don't necessarily apply as strongly as they do in the pharma industry. And so in engineering industry, you will find decisions are taken a lot quicker. They're a bit more rough around the edges in terms of what decisions are taken. And it sort of impacts the way that business goes about its business and the way it makes decisions. And again, if you go back to the pharmaceutical industry, of course, you'll find that industry is a lot more reserved, a lot more cautious about decisions. It has to, because it has to comply with externally imposed regulations and ethics. And so those are some good examples that impact culture. And of course, those regulatory and ethical standards have to be displayed by the senior leadership team of that business. And so anybody further down the organization structure sees the way that those senior leaders respond and sees the way that they bring in ethics and governance and regulatory compliance as part of their language and conversation, and it filters down through the business. So it's not surprising that when you get into a pharmaceutical business, you find it a lot more considerate, a lot more concerned about doing the right thing and about being seen to be compliant with all of those external factors. So that for me is, but by the way, that's just the starting block.
Yes.
Because then you can overlay that with the personality style of the leadership team, which is additional to all of those regulatory and compliance that factors I've just mentioned.
Correct.
So there's layers upon layers, which then start to inform the way that business starts to react, both internally and the way it reacts to its external stakeholders.
Absolutely. And in fact, one of the examples that I often end up citing about the regulatory is the comparison between hospitals and hospitality industry. Both are very people-centric, but hospitals are extremely governed by regulatory approvals, regulatory frameworks, whereas hospitality is more focused on experience, you know, customer experience and stuff like that. So
you could say the only comparison in the hospitality industry is there's a regulatory control that says you've got to throw somebody out of the bar if you think they're under 18, right, and not allowed to drink alcohol.
exactly.
Yeah.
When it comes to the world of M&A, and we know that there are enough examples where people have cited culture as one of the reasons why integrating companies has been a struggle. We understand that the cultures of different organizations are different. We also know that even within organizations, departments have their own culture. And then one of the factors, or one of the things that make up culture, is individual people values, right? So a leader may demonstrate a certain set of values, which may or may not be in line with the company culture. Why is it a challenge in the world of M&A?
It's interesting, because while I was thinking about, and I hope you don't laugh at this, but while I was thinking about getting ready for this podcast today, it suddenly occurred to me that if you look at any business, there's a CFO, director of finance, there's a director of sales, there's a director of marketing, there's a director of operations. And for all the other functions across, there is no senior management role as a director of culture.
Sorry, I couldn't stop laughing at that.
It just occurred to me.
Yes.
And we sort of treat it historically as this touchy feeling concept that belongs in HR.
Yeah.
Right. But it, for me, it's such an important function of a business that I had to stop myself today and go, hang on a minute. Why doesn't culture have a director level who is directly responsible for that in a business?
That's right.
And the fact is,
very good call out.
The fact is we don't. And so culture's been, because we can't put it in a functional bucket as such, what you find in M&A is that we take a functional approach. you've bought another company, and we say, right, okay, we're going to get, you know, all the finance integrated. We're going to integrate the IT systems. We're going to integrate sales. We're going to integrate marketing, you know, and so on and so forth. And for all of those functional areas, everybody would go, yes, of course, that's obvious. You've got to do that.
Right.
And you would go into the acquired company and you would get a hold of the IT director or the CIO or the sales director or the marketing director or whoever, and you would start to drive that process. My argument is that traditionally as leaders, we haven't seen culture as a serious topic in the same vein that we look at finance, HR, marketing, sales, operations, and so on.
That's right.
That's one point of it. And the other point of it is that unless you've got a career in HR, most other senior managers wouldn't have direct experience of cultural change in their careers. So it's the runt of the litter. It's the piece that gets left behind until it's too late. And then you realize that it's actually having a very serious impact on the acquisition that you've just made.
Right.
And the unfortunate thing that you and I have spoken about is that that often isn't understood until you're post-deal and some way into the integration process.
Yep.
So that's the underlying or the fundamental challenge that we face over and over again.
That's right. In fact, as you're saying it, a thought occurs to me, which is, almost all senior leaders in an organization, especially in the corporate and the mid-sized world, would have undergone some sort of leadership training. And in the leadership training, there is an emphasis on individual values and growth values and that stuff. Do you think the way modern day management works, which is managed by numbers, is one of the main reasons why culture is not taken up by the leaders and kind of given to the HR guys? Because, hey, you know what? If it's to do with people, it's a job of HR. It's a responsibility for the HR people.
And in fact, if you know, when I grew up in my career, it was called HR, human resources.
Yes.
And if you actually talk to organizations today, it's now called P&C,
yes,
people and culture, right? Which even more significantly cements it in that bracket.
Right.
Think about MBA courses,
mm-hmm,
or you do a degree in business or anything of that nature. There's a strong focus on understanding finance and balance sheets and P&L statements. There's a strong focus on marketing and sales and on operational management and productivity and efficiencies and all of those factors. You spend a lot of time looking at case studies that you know are driven by all those sort of things. And if culture comes into it, it's brought in as a sort of a side game alongside the core case that you're learning about in your MBA, you know, experience. So it's hard to find in a university or an MBA course or anything like that, particular case studies that really focus on culture. They don't. And we've historically always sidelined culture as being a subset of HR.
Right.
So right from the beginning, we don't. It's just, again, a thought dropped into my head. Right from the beginning, we don't position or educate upcoming leaders to be skilled in cultural change, unless unless you happen to be lucky enough to become part of a management team where your leadership does see culture, and we're back to Jack Welch and people like that, when those people did see culture as a very important part of the business. And because of that, that mindset was pushed down through the organization. So you started to realize that if you did not consider the way that we treat people and the way that people present themselves and behave as part, then you were certainly going to be out of that business pretty quickly. But broadly across the whole spectrum of businesses, only those exceptional leaders that make culture a central theme where it becomes successful. For the many other businesses on the outside of that, culture's considered some sort of secondary, and in some cases sort of yes. You know, soft and touchy-feely type concept that only HR really knows about.
Right.
I'm being very hard and cruel there, but
yes.
Generally I think a lot of people listening would agree.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And part of the reason, I guess, we are looking at this particular topic is it's been cited as one of the main reasons why a lot of integrations fail. You know, the biggest example would be Daimler and Chrysler that failed because of the difference in... people say it's regional culture, but I don't say just regional culture. It's the management culture as well. The difference is there. Now, as you know, we've been involved in this, conducting this research on cultures, and I've also been penning thoughts to, you know, for a book there as well. One of the aspects that we realized while doing our research is every successful company that we have come across, all of them, 100% of them have a great culture.
Yep.
And that is like an aha moment, a light bulb moment, where it's like, okay, so which essentially means that it probably is one of the success criteria, one of the key ingredients that make great companies or successful companies great, because they have a strong and a robust and a great culture, right? On the other side, we know that in M&A, one of the reasons why it fails is because of culture. And one of the reasons why it's culture is because people are not able to navigate the different cultures. So, you know, how do you kind of bring together cultures, or how to take people from a less evolved culture to a more dominant culture, right? Mm-hmm. What are some of the things or some of the tasks or some of the thinking that organizations need to develop? Now, you obviously mentioned about director of culture, you know, and while we have the HR directors being renamed as people in culture, but their main focus has still been primarily people instead of the culture. What are some of the pieces that organizations should look at when they're trying to do an integration?
Well, if I'm not jumping the gun, first of all, let's talk about culture at different levels. So we live in a global economy these days.
Yes.
And for most of the larger businesses that you and I would deal with, they will have a presence in multiple countries.
That's right.
And whether we like it or not, each country has its own national culture.
Yeah.
That to some degree drives or is an integral part of a company's culture. And then, of course, within the company, you get departmental culture as well, and so on and so forth. What I was coming back to was that when you start to unpick culture, there's a number of driving factors. And I'll just put national culture to one side for a minute.
Sure.
Because the heading I put under national culture is respect.
Mm-hmm.
So that means respect for each other. And you need to drive that principle across the business, so that the UK team has got respect for the US team, has got respect for the French team, has got respect for the Indian team. There's broad respect. But then when you get down to the detail, it's about the way you're employed, right? The contractual terms that you're employed under, and the value of the job that you do in that organization. And then you layer that with the way that you're paid, the remuneration that you're given, as to whether that is a respectful remuneration for the job that you're doing. And then you layer on top of that topics like the environment that you're working in, and whether that's a comfortable environment for you to be able to carry out the tasks and duties. And we layer on top of that the internal communication within the business, and the way that you have freedom of communication within your peers, horizontally in the business and vertically in the business, all the way up to senior management. So you start to see that culture has got many moving parts. Essentially, I know your business, Fifth Chrome, has developed a model that you call the promise model of culture, which I think has got 7 moving parts to it. that model, the thing that takes me to that model is that each one of those moving parts has to be in balance with the others.
That's right.
So you can't have a culture where you get excessive pay, but you're working in terrible conditions.
Right.
Or where you've got good pay and good conditions, but there is zero opportunity to communicate across the business, and so on and so forth. So culture becomes the combination of those building blocks, and if you find yourself in an M&A environment where you've got to where you've got to improve the culture of the business that you've just acquired, or
right,
adjust the culture of the business you've just acquired, it's not a singular task.
Right.
You've got to touch all of those 7 elements in order to achieve a consistent outcome of cultural change.
Right.
I hope that makes sense.
No, absolutely. You know, the funny thing is, while you were referring to the promise framework, you know, and obviously this is not a marketing podcast for our framework anyway, but I guess we have probably got a bit radicalized with our framework, because now we believe that framework addresses the cultural issues, but more importantly, there are underlying factors that make up a culture of an organization, and that there is a universal truth there. The way people behave is an embodiment of the underlying factors, practices, the rituals that people follow, the norms that people follow, the protocols that people follow. You know, all of them have these factors under that. Now, we are in 2022, you know, and literally sort of at the cusp of going into 2023. You know, you and I, we've been involved in M&A deals, you know, back from the 20th century. Back in the 20th century, it used to be quite asset-heavy acquisitions in majority of the cases, unless you were a law firm and you merged, or an accounting firm that you merged. In 2022, we see a lot more professional services company and a lot more knowledge management company and people-centric company. Culture should be an important part of that equation, especially for the M&A. Do you see the landscape changing in terms of people's views when they look at M&A and think of culture as a more powerful tool or more as an enabler function than ever before?
The recognition of culture as an integral element of M&A is certainly improving from those terrible bad old days of asset stripping and et cetera.
Right.
where culture wasn't even considered. It's been driven by three factors, I think. It's been driven by the emergence of the large consulting groups who, like you and I, have seen that culture is an integral element of M&A, and to be absolutely honest about it, they've seen that they can make money from selling their advice on that area.
Right.
And so they create a department and a service that provides that advice to clients.
Yes.
The second area often is that you will get CEOs like the Jack Welch's of this world. Now, Jack Welch, of course, is known universally by everybody.
Yes.
But there are also CEOs that are in the same mold as Jack Welch in smaller businesses around this world, but they carry the same principles that Jack Welch did.
Right.
And so culture becomes much more widely known or driven by those CEOs, by the leadership team that see that as an important factor.
Right.
And then the third element is that, whether we like it or not, there's been many M&A deals. You mentioned the Daimler Chrysler one, where culture's actually scuppered the deal completely, and it's fallen apart, you know, and cost millions of dollars in lost opportunity because culture wasn't considered during the deal thesis. So there's those three factors that are more prominent now in today's marketplace than they were back in, as you said, the 20th century, which definitely makes us sound old, by the way.
What are some of the good examples from a cultural perspective that you've seen in an M&A? You know, examples where companies have done something that has accelerated either value realization faster or prevented unwanted attrition. So any example that you care to share?
Probably like you, I've seen more examples where culture has been the destroyer of deals. But I'll use one example. Now, this company, I'm not going to mention their name, And I'll have to say that they recognized culture was an issue just in time.
Right.
So this was a very large multi-billion dollar company in the commodities market.
Right.
And the commodity that they sold was under global price pressure. So the margin in the product was dropping and dropping and dropping.
Right.
And this company decided that the best strategy to try and address this was to add technology as a service add function to the commodity.
Right. Right. That's clever.
And so in this particular case, and I can't give the technology away because the minute I do, people will understand that the industry. So they went out and they acquired a business with leading edge technology. Now, the business they acquired was less than $200 million revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a $7.4 billion business that was making the acquisition. Right. So you had David and Goliath sort of thing.
Yes.
Yeah. The 800-pound gorilla on one side and the little minion on the other.
Right.
And it was only just as the deal was closing that one of the directors in the business got up and said, if we allow our respective sales teams to go out and sell to our customers side by side, we are going to fall into a very big problem, because our sales team, being the 700-pound gorilla,
yes,
is going to bully the technology acquisition. And they realized that just in time.
Right.
And in fact, when I say just in time, it was almost just in time, because there'd been a couple of occurrences in the early days where the two sales teams had gone out to talk to clients and it had been absolutely disastrous.
Right.
Because the acquiring company, the $7.4 billion gorilla, turned round to the other salespeople and basically said, righto, this is our customer. This is my sales deal. You sit in the corner, keep your mouth shut. I'll tell you when to talk, and you say what I tell you to say.
Right.
And of course, that went down like a lead balloon.
Right.
But they realized that. Luckily, at a senior level, a director realized that was going to be an issue, called it out, called for action, and they addressed it.
Brilliant. Right. Brilliant.
And it resulted in a more comprehensive, it resulted in the large corporate sales team recognizing that their future and their commissions were dependent on this technology business being sold into their deals.
Right.
And so they became a meeting of equals.
Sure.
A respect for both sides, and that translated into a positive presentation in front of the clients.
Right.
But it almost fell over because
yes.
of that.
Yes. And I think that's such an important part of dealing with culture. It's the, you know, you talked about the regional culture, country culture, national culture, and respect. But I think the same yardstick should also be used in for organization culture. It's the ability to listen, understand, as well as respect the other's culture. They are different, and therefore they have to be respected first, and then we talk about how do we bridge the gap between cultures. Yeah.
Well, if I can use another example, as you say, from our 20th century experience, I was one of those people in the early days when the Western world suddenly started doing a lot of business with Japan.
Right. Oh, yes.
And so I was one of those execs that was suddenly in Japan meeting with Japanese business people. And I recall one of my own horror experiences of going into a major client. There was a big meeting.
Yeah.
I knew it was in the boardroom. It was in our boardroom, right? And so the time came for the meeting, and I walked over to the boardroom, and there's about 15 Japanese people standing outside just waiting.
Right.
And I thought, well, what's all this about? Right. And I walked straight into the boardroom and did what I always did, found myself a chair where I felt what I wanted to sit, and sat myself down. And I could see these guys looking at me with absolute horror.
Right.
And of course, what I realized afterwards was that the reason why they were all standing outside was because the most senior person hadn't arrived yet.
Yeah.
And the meeting only started when that senior person walked into the room and decided where they wanted to sit.
Yes.
And then depending on your seniority, depending on where you were allowed to sit around that table.
That's right.
And of course, you didn't know that until that senior person sat down. And here I was. I just walked in, sat myself down and got myself ready. And
absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, it reminds me of one of my earlier career examples. So this was, I was working at that point and I'm in Singapore for a Japanese company. And one of the presentations I did, so we had a few Japanese managers in the room, and you know, this is early days in my career, right? So they were nodding and, you know, to what I was presenting. And then my boss couldn't make to that presentation. So after the meeting, he asked me, is like, okay, Anirvan, how did the meeting go? I said, yeah, well, you know, I think the meeting went well because all of them were nodding and acknowledging. Back then I didn't realize that the nodding and acknowledging in the Japanese culture is about, yes, I've understood what you're saying. I've listened Absolutely. To you. Yeah. It does yeah. not mean, unlike in the Western world, it does not mean that they agree to what you're saying, you know, and that's yeah. such an important lesson to be learned, because our proposal was indeed not passed through back then, because yeah, that's how it is.
Well, I'll allow one more example and you sure. can cut this out if you want to. again, it was in my SAP days. I was visiting SAP Japan.
Right.
And I arrived about 4:30 in the afternoon.
Yeah.
And I just dropped in the office to sort of say hello to the country manager. And I had work to do. And he turned around to me and said, oh, that's okay, Rob. Use my office, right? I've got a client call to make on my way home. So feel free, use the office.
Sure.
So, oh, great. Okay. So I sat down in his office and started working. And I was conscious that a young lady had come and she'd taken all the drawers out the photocopier and taken all the paper out and sort of, shuffled it all, put it all back and put the drawers back, and then polished this photocopier. Oh, okay. very nice attention to detail. But about half an hour later, she came back and started to do the same thing again.
Right.
Hold on. You know, and I looked at my watch, it was like 6:45 in the evening. And I thought, and the office was still full. and so I got up and I went out and I said, hey, you know, haven't you guys got a home to go to? You know, like, go home. You know, it's like, it's getting late, you know. And I got the same thing. I got, yes, okay. You know, and I went back in the office and they still stayed there.
Yes.
And of course, what I realized was that they were not allowed to leave. It was unpolite.
Yes.
To leave the office before the boss.
Yes.
And as far as they were concerned, I was sitting in the boss's office,
chair.
So I was exactly. the boss. and that they wouldn't go home. And I actually had to pack up and go and do the rest of my work in the hotel because they wouldn't leave until I left.
That's right. That's right.
And that's another example of behavioral culture.
Yes.
That you have to be considerate of when, yeah. And it comes back to that argument that M&A today is a global practice.
Yes.
And we are dealing with global cultures as well as corporate cultures.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. I was just looking at the watch you and I, we could probably talk about this topic, till the cows come home, as they say. Just a few rapid fire questions. You've already mentioned about our tool, and this podcast is not about our framework, our tool, but other tools or frameworks or technology principles that you've seen being used for culture as far as M&A is concerned.
Look, I think what I will say is that we've already identified that culture is the assemblance of several moving parts.
Right.
And you have to be able to deal with each of those moving parts in its own right, but as part of the whole.
Sure.
And so what a model does is it allows you to actually then take culture
right
and unpack it into those those different components. Now, you know, whether you break it down into six components, eight components, 10 components, it doesn't matter. What a model allows you to do is treat each component in its individuality.
Right.
But as part of the whole at the same time.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's the old question, how do you eat an elephant?
Right.
The answer is in small pieces.
It's one piece at a time, yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. And culture's the same. You address culture by unpacking it into its respective components.
Yes.
And then treating each of those components individually, but in a manner where each component has got equality to the other components in the model.
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost so an orchestra, right? You've got the conductor. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good analogy.
Right.
Because if you've got an orchestra made up of woodwind, percussion, strings, etc., right, you imagine if one of those parts of the orchestra is playing
out of tune,
one beat out of tune with the rest.
Yeah.
It's horrible. It's absolutely horrible.
Yeah.
Right. And that's a really good analogy with corporate culture. The same thing applies. You get one of those factors out of tune with the rest.
Yes, absolutely.
And you get massive cultural problems.
Yeah, yeah. What's the nastiest or most disdainful thing that you've seen being used under the garb of culture?
I'll give two quick examples.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily nastiest, but I was involved in an M&A at one time where a Singapore-headquartered technology business was acquiring a Korea-based technology business. The Singapore business had a culture with its customers of nurture and grow. In other words, put time into the relationship, be respectful of what the clients try to achieve, understand their business, etc. The Korean business, their sales methodology was get in there, kill it, and get out as fast as you can and sell it for whatever you can achieve.
Right.
And so they were massively different approaches to the way they approach their customer base. And that one had all the elements of going disastrously wrong. And we had to do some real quick surgery to change it. And that meant getting rid of the leadership team on the Korean side.
Right.
And changing the compensation model of salespeople. So they were compensated. They earned their commission now for nurturing and growing customers, not just getting in there and getting the sale for all cost.
Right.
So that was a good example of a nasty approach in culture. Right. The other one that I will just mention, but it was more a reflection of the times than anything else. And that again is back into our wonderful 20th century. when there were a number of people around that were considered, just asset strippers.
Yes.
Right. And so they simply went into an acquisition for the dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And there was zero, absolutely zero respect or consideration for a company's culture. It's like, I don't even care.
Right. Right.
I've just spent $36 million on your business, and I know that I can realize $50 million of value out of it.
Yeah.
And if you happen to be one of the casualties for doing that, well, tough.
Yeah.
And luckily, we've gone way past those days now.
Yeah.
And the good thing about those days, I spent a good part of my career involved in that M&A activity, that sort of M&A activity. And what it did for me was it helped me understand how not to do something.
Sure. Great examples there. One personal question. Any favorite business books, you know, not necessarily related to culture or M&A necessarily, but any favorite business book?
You know, one thing I will say is I spend so much of my career in business.
Right.
That I actually don't really read what you might call business books, because from my point of view, a lot of them are, you know, how to do this, how to do that.
Right.
You know, that doesn't bother me. But there is a particular type of book I do enjoy. And if you'll bear with me for 10 seconds.
Sure.
Because you see, I'm in my library here.
Yeah.
And I'll show you the book that I do enjoy reading. And I've read this book probably 3 or 4 times now.
Okay. Excellent. Yeah. Straight from the gut.
The thing about this book is that this is Jack Welch talking about his own experiences.
Yes.
Right. These are Jack Welch reflecting on the challenges he faced and how he got around them. They're personal war stories.
Yeah.
That I do enjoy reading.
Yeah.
But the classic, you know, business book, funnily enough, is another one that I read that's also, and you'll smile again.
Yeah. Yeah, did you ever listen to Susie Welch's podcasts with Jack Welch?
No. I think I told you a story one time. I actually went to a business conference.
Right.
And I got put on the dinner sort of thing. And I got put on a table, and this was who was sitting next to me.
Right.
You know, and he's one of those world's inspirational leaders.
Yep, yeah, absolutely. Right? Yeah.
And Jack Welch didn't know me from Adam.
Sure.
At that time when I sat down there, but he made me feel respected, and he listened to what I had to say, and he was respectful of my views and thoughts. And we had a great conversation over dinner.
Right.
Luckily, by sheer chance, that I just got sat next to him.
Right.
At a conference dinner.
Yeah,
But I'm not a big fan of the classic how-to business.
How-to, books. Yes, yes.
No.
That makes sense. And thanks for sharing those two books. And in fact, if Jack Welch was the earlier Japanese example that you'd shared, you know, maybe you wouldn't even get a chance to sit next to him if people followed the hierarchy protocols.
Exactly. That was absolute pure chance. I've got to just add a little bit of I was embarrassed.
Sure.
Because when I sat down at the table,
yeah,
and this guy was sitting at the side of me,
yeah,
I didn't know who it was.
Sure.
And I had to introduce myself and ask him his name.
Right.
Right. And he said, "Oh, I'm Jack Welch."
Yeah.
Right. And I said, "Oh, Jack, you know, pleased to meet you."
Yeah.
And about 5 nanoseconds later,
yeah,
I sat there thinking, "No, it can't be."
Yeah.
And it was.
Yeah.
It was Jack Welch.
Yeah. You know, yeah. No, absolutely, absolutely. No, thanks for sharing those.
But what I will say is,
sure,
he spoke to me like he would speak to anybody else.
That's right.
Right. There's no airs and graces with him.
Yeah.
He's a great guy, and he just talks to everybody on the same level.
Yes. Yes. Very.
And that's
true.
That again is an important part of what we're talking about culture.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, this book I read, or rather when I read this book, I actually got to know so much more about GE's culture, because literally, you know, while we were shown these are the employee values, these are the way we do things, these are your policies and procedures, but what kind of binds it together? Why do we operate like the way we operate? This was so greatly explained in that book. I mean, that was like an That was like a complete transformation in my own way of thinking about culture of an organization. So great call out. Thank you for that. And you know, I know we're sort of running over time here, but such a fantastic discussion. One last question. If you were to meet a CEO in an elevator or a lift, as we call it in other parts of the world, and that person was looking at acquiring another company, what advice would you give on culture to him? And this is not just consulting speech, but what advice would you give him or her?
Irrespective of who I was talking to, my advice would be the same.
Yeah.
You need to consider culture as early as possible in your deal thesis. Probably when you're sitting around the boardroom table, identifying the target and talking to your fellow directors, you need to understand or at least think about the culture of the target company that you're looking to acquire. And right. then you need to put a lot of effort into the due diligence process
right.
to look at how well that company's culture will fit your own internal culture.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you carry that through into post-deal integration. Hopefully by that time, you've got a damn good idea of whether you need to change the culture and to what degree.
Yeah.
But the earlier you can do it, the better.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And a great way of putting it, unpacking culture as it goes along the M&A life cycle, but start early. Yeah. Start from the top. Yeah.
Absolutely. And hopefully don't give it to HR. they need to be involved. People
yes.
in culture need to be involved in the process, but it's not a singular
functional, correct.
No.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
It's far too important. It's pervasive across the entire business.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Yeah, that absolutely makes sense. If people were to get in touch with you, what's the best way to get in touch?
Oh, look me up on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
And you'll get all my contact details on there.
Yeah.
Go to the Global PMI Partners website, which is gpmip.com.
Yeah.
And you'll find me on there. And I'd be delighted to talk to anybody that wants to discuss M&A.
Brilliant. We'll put the details in the show notes of the podcast or the video here so that you can get connected with Robert Heaton either through LinkedIn or through GPMIP. All right. That kind of brings us to the end of it. Robert, as usual, this is been a blast. I learned so much and so many different examples. So really, really happy that you could join us today for our episode. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure, Anirvan, and thank you for the invitation. And I hope that you and I talk well on the topic. We're both professionals in that area, and I hope the listeners get a lot from this podcast.
I hope you guys enjoyed the show today. This show was sponsored by Fifth Chrome, a business strategy advisor in a training company specializing in M&A, post-merger integration, and business strategy.
Did you like today's content? If yes, then don't forget to hit the like button. If you heard something interesting, then don't forget to share it with your network and friends. And last but not least, please support us on this journey to spread awareness on topics related to M&A and integration by subscribing to our channel. That's all for now. Stay healthy and see you next time.
And if you like this episode, I'm sure you'll also like our latest new tool. It has a quick assessment scorecard to assess the robustness of your M&A integration design. It just takes less than 5 minutes to answer. It is for free and you can get instantaneous recommendation. So visit maintegrationplan.scoreapp.com and find out for yourself.